It's time now for the PDXO WASP podcast, brought to you by the Open Web Application Security Project. The views of the guests do not necessarily represent the views of OWASP, their sponsors, and other stakeholders. Enjoy the show.
Our special guest today is Eva Galprin, who's the Director of Cybersecurity at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF. Prior to 2007, when she came to work for EFF, Eva worked in security and IT in Silicon Valley and earned degrees in political science and international relations from San Francisco State University. Her work is primarily focused on providing privacy and security for vulnerable populations around the world. To that end, she has applied the combination of her political science and technical background to everything from organizing EFS Tor Relay Challenge to writing privacy and security training materials, including surveillance self-defense and the digital first aid kit, and publishing research on malware in Syria, Vietnam, and Kazakhstan. When she's not collecting new and exotic malware, she practices aerial circus arts and learning new languages.
So our guest today is Eva Galprin, the Director of Cybersecurity for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, also known as EFF. We are so happy to have you today on our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Eva, you definitely have had a fascinating and eventful life journey in security. I'm hoping you can just kind of give our listeners an insight to that journey and how you got to where you are today.
Oh, I always feel like this is such a strange question. Like, how did you become a talking dog? At the same time, I grew up in Silicon Valley. My parents were geeks. They left books on cryptography strategically lying around the house and said, gee, I really hope you don't pick any of these up, which was the best way to get me to pick things up and read them. And I went into IT. I did security. I did security consulting. And I dropped out of college where I was getting a degree in computer science because I was busy doing computer science. And what I told my parents at the time that I dropped out of college was that, oh, don't worry, when the economy collapses, I will go back to school. And I was lying. But as it turns out, the economy did collapse and I did go back to school and I went and I got a degree in political science and international relations with an emphasis in Chinese. I had spent a bunch of time studying Chinese internet censorship. My intention was to go to law school. I was going to go become a lawyer because obviously this tech thing wasn't working out. And I got into law school and I had was preparing to move when my partner said, can we just like not move to New York or Chicago? And I said, but this is where I got into law school. And he asked me to stick around for a bit. And I was like, just delay it for a year, take a job, see what happens. And the place where I went to go work doing legal intake was the Electronic Frontier Foundation. This was 2007. There were 23 people at the organization. And when I came in to do my interview, adorably enough, they were like, have you heard of us? Because they thought that they were maybe something very obscure. And I explained to them that I had been at DEF CON in the early 2000s when Dmitry Siklarov was arrested for giving a talk about how to break Adobe ebook encryption. And the thing that I heard from everybody was, it's going to be all right. EFF is on the case. And I thought, these are the good guys. I want to be a good guy. That would be great. And a couple of years later, I did. I have worked in just about every part of EFF because I started out with legal intake, talking to the people who wanted EFF to take on their cases pro bono. We take on all of our cases pro bono. We do impact litigation. I went to go work on the activism team where I worked on the Stop SOPA PIPA and internet blackout campaigns. I also worked on the Tor Relay project. I went to go work on our international team and did a bunch of international activism during the Arab Spring. And then I started, publishing security research. It started out with an interest in how the Syrian government was man in the middling SSL certificates, which was a thing that was happening when the Syrian government, near the beginning of the Syrian civil war, suddenly unbanned Facebook. And everybody was like, man, this Bashar al-Assad, he is the father of the Syrian internet. He's really great. Let's give him a two-page spread in a fashion magazine, a thing that actually happened. And the end result was that, no, Bashar al-Assad did not do this out of the goodness of his heart, that he had essentially opened up access to Facebook so that he could try to get people to use his government SSL certificate, a fake SSL certificate, and he would therefore be able to spy on their encrypted Facebook communications, because it's not like Facebook was going to hand over that information to Syria. Though that wasn't quite sure at the time. So I worked on that. I spent a bunch of time studying APTs. I wrote reports about some new APTs in Vietnam, in Kazakhstan, in Lebanon. And for the most part, one of the really interesting things that was happening in APT land was that mostly people were publishing about, Five Eyes, Russia, Israel, and China. And if you weren't a top tier player, the security industry was largely uninterested in campaigns because they were just too primitive to think about. There were no points to score by unveiling campaigns against Syrian activists, because Syrian activists were never going to buy your product. They couldn't buy anything. So I spent some time working on this sort of civil society aspect of APTs, which in the end sort of translated to going after APTs by caring about the victimology rather than the sophistication of the actors. Then I ran around the world talking to journalists and activists, working on getting them digital security trainings. And in 2016, there was a sudden spike in requests for digital security trainings inside of the United States for human rights and civil society organizations for some strange reason that I can't even begin to speculate about. And so lots of people wanted to become trainers. There were lots of people who had experience as in IT, who had experience in security, and they saw people organizing all over the world and cringed at their OPSEC, and they said, we want to help. And what I discovered over my years of traveling all over the world doing these trainings is that IT people and security people make terrible trainers. And part of that is because teaching is a skill, and we completely underestimate how important the art of teaching is, and we don't bother learning any of it. And we think that if we just get up in front of a bunch of people and demonstrate our mastery of OPSEC, that this is the same thing as having taught them, and that we could, just fly away going, my work here is done. And that's simply not true. And then a few years ago, I started a group inside of EFF called Threat Lab. And Threat Lab is a group of researchers whose work is focused entirely on threats to vulnerable populations. So we're really trying to change the way that people think about cybersecurity. I dragged a whole bunch of my ideas from political science and international relations into this. And the idea was that when we talk about cybersecurity, we very rarely ask security for whom. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about who deserves security. And by default, the people who are sort of centered in the security security community and in the security conversation are governments and enterprises and rich people, people with money, people who are going to buy products. And those are actually not the people who need the protection the most. Often the people who need the protection the most are people whose concerns are pushed to the periphery. When I first started getting companies to move over to HTTPS by default in order to protect Syrian activists who were being, kidnapped by the by the Assad regime. They told me, well, that's an edge case. Well, maybe it's an edge case. You know, there aren't a lot of them, but just how many people are you okay with dying as a result of your not having HTTPS by default? Just let me know. Give me like a low number and we'll work from there. I'm a very good negotiator. So I worked on that for a while. And then for the last couple of years, I've been working on Stalkerware, which is essentially the same products only made commercially available to consumers and created with the intent of allowing people to spy on their cheating spouses or you know wayward children or pretty much anyone else that they want to harass.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that was a long list. And I think we'll probably dive a little deeper into a couple of those topics that you mentioned. But one thing, I was just curious, what have you found to be like the greatest challenge that you and your team have overcome or a major lesson learned?
I think that probably I learn a major lesson with every project. I try to come to every project with the understanding that my assumptions are probably wrong. And that has been true with almost every project that I have worked on. When I started working on Stalkerware, I thought that the problem that that victims of domestic abuse had was that their partners would threaten them. They would install Stalkerware apps on their phone, and then because the survivor had no technical experience, they simply did not know whether or not their phone was safe. And I thought that the solution to this would be to reach out to people and say, well, you know, I will make sure that a full forensic analysis gets done of your phone. I'm sure you can already see the problem with this theory. The first being that it does not scale. And the second is that when people came to me with their stories of harassment and abuse, the most common sort of compromise that I saw was account compromise. And I was so relieved because we have solutions for account compromise. We can walk people through what to do when your account is compromised. And it turned out that nearly every time when people thought that they had Stalkerware installed on their devices, it was a case of account compromise. But it turned out Stalkerware was still a major problem and still is. And so I spent a bunch of time talking to AV companies about getting them to actually recognize Stalkerware as potentially unwanted programs so that people have the option of removing it from their devices.
So happy birthday. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, turned 30 years old last week. And some of the famous founders, of course, is Steve Wozniak and Mitch Kapor. And for those who don't know, what's EFF's primary mission today? And has it changed in any significant way since its inception in 1990? And are there challenges that EFF faces today that were unforeseen back then?
So I was not at EFF in 1990. I am not that old. I hadn't even heard of EFF in 1990. I came to work at EFF in 2007. But I can tell you that that EFF's mission is to make sure that when you go online, your rights come with you. And this has always been the case. Whether we do it through building tools like Privacy Badger or HTTPS Everywhere or CertBot, or we do it by getting people to do security trainings, creating, you know, practically you know, one of the few guides online that is regularly updated. The internet is just this graveyard of unupdated security and privacy guides. Personal peeve. So we do it that way. We do it by filing lawsuits that we think are going to do good. We do it by building tools, and we do it occasionally by, you know, getting out into the streets or by, you know, writing to our representatives or writing to the companies that run the platforms that we depend on or that make the products that we depend on. So it's all about just having a bunch of tools in the toolbox all to really do the same thing.
Awesome. Yeah, I think those tools are really great and definitely worth using as a user. I use a lot of them, especially Privacy Badger. Even at your own company, it's good to know what Privacy Badger identifies on the applications your teams are building.
I very much enjoyed the meeting at which we named Privacy Badger.
Yeah. Yeah, the little icon is cute too. So last year, you touched on this a little bit in your intro. You gave a talk at B-Sides that was all about if you're a subject matter expert in security domain, it doesn't necessarily make you a great person to teach someone else. More importantly, you can have a pretty damaging effect on people if you don't take the right approach when teaching. Could you talk a little bit more about the comprehensive security education campaign resource that EFF provides online and how people can access it and take advantage of it?
Sure. We call this the Security Education Companion, and you can get to it at sec.eff.org. I think there are also links to it on our privacy and security guide, which is surveillance self-defense, which you can get to at ssd.eff.org. Our guides are regularly updated. Our materials are regularly updated. Everything has a little date on it that tells you the last time that that something was updated, so that you can decide, kind of how fresh is this advice? How current is it? So the Security Education Companion really came around because so many people in IT wanted to contribute, because people who were in this field wanted to do good. And often we are the people who, go home over Thanksgiving and, fix everybody's computer problems. That's one of the things we're called upon to do. Mm-hmm. If you work in security, you also work in, extremely small scale IT for your family. You are the person that they come to for security or privacy advice. And often people who work in this field are that resource for their entire community. They're, that person who gets asked by, by their school or their church or their, local activism group, hey, what tools should I use? Hey, can you set up a blah, blah, blah? Or, hey, is this safe? Unfortunately, teaching is hard. It turns out that there are people who go to school in order to get master's degrees in teaching. That this is not just about getting up in front of people and demonstrating your mastery of the subject. And in fact, getting up in front of people and demonstrating your mastery of the subject without empowering your audience, without understanding your audience, usually just scares them so much that they don't do anything at all. And that is the exact opposite of what I would like to see happen. I lost count of the number of times early on when I would give a training and people would just sort of laugh and go, well, now I'm really scared. And that's only the beginning of the process. You start out a little scared and a little bit intimidated, but you need to finish that training feeling empowered and informed, or that training really hasn't done any good.
So Eva, you mentioned this, you've been a leading voice against organizations and individuals that make or promote stalkerware. And by the way, we recommend our listeners to watch your TED Women 2019 talk online. It's titled, What You Need to Know About Stalkerware. Once again, what is stalkerware and what is the coalition against stalkerware?
So stalkerware is the sort of subset of apps that are commercially available that exist for the purpose of surveilling a device. What they do usually is you go to a website, you download the thing, you upload it onto whatever device it is you're looking to spy on, and then you pay a monthly subscription to a portal run by the company that provides you this software, and they exfiltrate all of the data to a CNC that portal sees. Stalkerware is surprisingly common. And more importantly, there has been a feeling in the security industry that stalkerware is somehow okay, that spying on your spouse is all right if you think that they're cheating, that spying on your kids is all right if you think they're misbehaving, that spying on your employees is okay if you think that they're goofing off during the time when you are paying them to work. And it's not. There's a lot of question about exactly how legal it is, and a lot of that really depends on what jurisdiction you're in, how you're doing the spying, and what kind of consent you have. But in the end, trying to fool people into thinking that their devices are not spying on them when you are in fact spying on them is immoral and abusive and goes hand in hand with a tremendous amount of the abuse that I saw during the 2 years that I ran a project where victims of domestic abuse would come to me with their technical problems. So what is the Coalition Against Spyware? Against Stalkerware? The Coalition Against Stalkerware was sort of my answer to, well, what do we do about this Stalkerware problem? And it is a group of academics, sort of civil society people, sort of security practitioners who work directly on the ground with victims of domestic abuse, and companies, including security companies and a lot of antivirus vendors. And we are all working together to increase awareness about stalkerware, and also to change the way that the security industry deals with stalkerware, so that if you want to know if there is stalkerware on your computer or on your phone, all you need to do is download an antivirus program, and it will tell you if this thing is on your phone, which previously was simply not true much of the time.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing. I think that is a really important thing. And I think some of our listeners may ask this. Is there any way to volunteer and help out with this cause?
What I recommend to people, especially if you're sort of a solo IT security practitioner, is actually to go look at some of our member organizations. Go look at organizations like Operation Safe Escape or Weissering in Europe, and to volunteer for those organizations, because they are chronically understaffed and they need all the help that they can get. There are also some organizations that are not in the coalition that I recommend for if you want to do some technical helping out. I'm particularly fond of Badass, which is run by Caitlin Bowden. So I recommend reaching out to them. There's also Crash Override, which helps people who are sort of the targets of targeted harassment campaigns from the right. There is an organization called Unicorn Riot that does nothing but OSINT on Nazis and Proud Boys. There's a whole lot that you can do with your very particular set of skills.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing. I think that will be super useful for everyone. So EFF, you mentioned a few tools that they have online for privacy and security, including Privacy Badger and HTTPS Everywhere. Are there any other tools you would recommend? And what is the best way for our users, both technical and non-technical, to access them?
Well, the one additional tool that I would recommend if you are building a website is CertBot, which is a way of getting a free SSL certificate for your website. And what this means is that when people go to your website, that it will automatically show the website in HTTPS rather than HTTP. And this is part of our effort to encrypt the web and make it harder for people or for governments to do surveillance on traffic. Sorry, what was the other question?
What's the best way for them to access them if they're, maybe not as technical, maybe not in an engineering role?
All you have to do is go to the EFF website, www.eff.org. All of our tools are available there.
Speaking of volunteers, EFF as a whole, I know you're always looking for volunteers. Are there any particular areas of expertise that you could use the most help now?
There are a couple of mailing lists that we keep and for volunteers. One is a technical mailing list, which we call EFF Techs. And this is a mailing list that we reach out to when we need very specific sorts of technical help, or we need technical help in a particular location. EFF is located in San Francisco. We do not, in fact, have technologists all over the world, so we call upon our friends on occasion. There's also our cooperating attorneys list, which I ran for many years, and this is the list of lawyers who are interested in taking on the cases that we don't necessarily have the bandwidth to do ourselves, or that don't quite fall into EFF's mission statement, but are still very important. And you can sign up for either one of these mailing lists, again, by going to the EFF website. Or if you have questions about volunteering, you can also email info@eff.org, info@eff.org.
Thank you for sharing. So we have many people in our chapter, at least with the Portland OWASP group, and they range from super experienced security professionals to just graduating college, or maybe they're software engineers or in a variety of different fields and want to get into security. Can you maybe share any advice you have for people? How do they get involved with privacy and security? And maybe also on the other side for employers, how best to bring diversity to the security field?
Well, for people who are looking to sort of break into privacy and security, the suggestion that I have more than anything else is don't wait for permission. Don't wait for somebody to come along and bless you and say, now you are a security person. Now you are a privacy person. This industry is full of autodidacts, of people who taught themselves. And this is a fully legitimate way to go about, you know, sort of building your education. Just start taking things apart and see how they tick, much to the annoyance of my parents and our teacher. this is mostly what I recommend to practitioners. However, with a few caveats, the security industry and InfoSec is predominantly male, predominantly straight, predominantly white, and you know, generally of a certain age. There's also some weird age discrimination, which happens where after the moment you get a gray hair, you are suddenly no longer employable. And the further you are from that sort of vision of what a hacker looks like or what an information security person looks like, the more important it is for you to rack up certificates, to rack up sort of evidence that you know what you are doing. So a lot of the people who will tell you that certs don't matter, that trainings don't matter, are usually, you know, straight white guys of a certain age, because for them, they don't. But if we want more women in the field, if we want more queer people in the field, more people of color, more people from, you know, just diverse backgrounds of all kinds, we need to be welcoming of people who essentially have taught themselves through, you know, security trainings, through certifications, and through these kinds of experiences. There is no one way to do a security career, and there's no one way to do a privacy career. But what I recommend to people, if they're looking to do research, is, well, two things. One, go looking where nobody else is looking. Find the stuff that's being ignored. Find the people who are being pushed to the periphery, the people who are not the center of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And the other place to look is often in your own community. Start with the community that you know best. Start with the people that you know best and what their concerns are, and work your way out from there. But always the thing that should be at the center of our discussion of privacy and security should be the people who are normally pushed off to the periphery, the people who get ignored, the people without money, the people without power. Because otherwise, all that we're doing as privacy and security professionals is helping to empower the already entrenched kind of the status quo. I think we can do better.
Yeah, I completely agree. I kind of have a motto of you shouldn't have to pay for security. It should just be given. So I definitely do that part. Awesome.
So Eva, do you have any upcoming events to promote for EFF or for yourself?
Oh man, the 30th anniversary party. We had trivia and Animal Crossing and all of the other things. Let's see what we have coming up. I am doing a bunch of press right now because people care about TikTok. We just launched the Atlas of Surveillance, which is a searchable database of police agencies and the tech tools that they use to spy on communities. This is largely the work of Threat Labs' Dave Moss and an enormous number of volunteers. So one of the things that you can do is you can contribute to the Atlas of Surveillance. And the website shows you how, and you can get there at EFF.org. What else is going on? You can subscribe to our newsletter, where you may read our many blog posts. And the things that I have coming up are mostly involving some keynotes for a couple of conferences. And conferences are obviously all happening online right now because nobody is traveling. Nothing makes me sadder than to be invited to some conference and then just go, I can't. There's simply no way right now. So I'm doing a lot of staring at a screen and delivering talks and then hoping they went well.
Have you found any unique challenges with that?
I am much less good at giving talk without an audience. I think that interacting with the audience is really important and connecting to the audience is really important. And that's a very hard thing to do in a sort of remote conference situation.
Awesome. Yeah. I was just curious because I cannot imagine it would be very different.
Some people are.
Yeah. Well, we just wanted to thank you again for taking the time today to join us, the Portland OWASP group, and wishing you luck on your next keynote.
Thank you, Eva.
Thank you so much.
To hear this podcast again, visit anywhere a podcast is played. For more information, go to owasp.org/www/chapter/Portland.